Let's do what we do. Open our Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 5, verse number 10. And we'll do a real quick summary of the story we were working on last time. And then we will move on with the next story. In this story, Naaman of Syria, a commander of the kingdom immediately north of the northern kingdom of Israel, has been marked by God with leprosy. Remember, leprosy is a mark put there by God to indicate the need for a change. And in this case, Naaman needs to change into a believer in the one true God. He's apparently ripe for that conversion process. So he finds out that there is a prophet in Israel that can remove his leprosy if he will just go there. So he does. But things don't quite play out the way he expects. Because Elisha, the prophet, doesn't even come out of the house to talk with him. Doesn't put on a great big performance. Doesn't go through a whole big rigmarole. He just simply does this. For 2 Kings 5:10, Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go and dunk yourself in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman was angry, and he went away saying, "Behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of he who is his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. And so I spent quite a little bit of time talking about the fact that this guy thought that God had to follow his expectations, his rules, when in fact, God is God. And when he sets a standard, no matter what that standard is, even if it's something super simple, that's what he expects to be followed. And so this guy was going to go away. He was going to just give up on the idea of getting his leprosy removed. But thankfully, he had good people around him, servants that cared. Verse 13, "But his servants came near and said to him, 'My father, it's a great word of the prophet that he's spoken to you. Will you not do it? Has he actually said to you, wash and be clean?'" So they basically say, "Look, you were expecting something big and dynamic, but he's given you something simple. Why don't you just do it? You know, just do what God expects of you, what he calls you to do." And so he listens to this reason. And he went down and he dipped himself. He immersed himself 7 times in the Jordan according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. And he was clean. Great story. And I applied it yesterday to the idea that a lot of people, for some reason, get hung up on the simple thing that is given in the New Testament of being immersed into the death and the resurrection of Jesus, being immersed in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and that that is a simple part of the conversion process for Christians. It's not a big deal. It's simple to do. Anybody pretty much can perform the ceremony without any difficulty whatsoever. And yet a lot of people balk at it. And they make up their own stuff, like raising hands and saying sinner's prayers and touching televisions and radios and taking a step forward in a crowded auditorium and kneeling at a kneeling bench and praying through. All these things are not to be found in the scriptures of New Testament. Nowhere. But a simple washing ceremony is. And so my advice to you again today, just like it was yesterday, is if you haven't done the simple thing asked of you to be immersed into the name of Jesus, into his death and his resurrection, what are you waiting for? Just do what God said. It's simple and easy. Why would you be like Naaman was doing and gonna run away in a snit and just not do the simple thing? Okay, enough of that encouragement. Let's move on to the rest of this story. Verse 15. Then he returned to the man of God, he and all his company. So again, I think Elisha must be somewhere not very far from the River Jordan when this event happens. And so the whole entourage comes back again. And Naaman stands before Elisha, and he said, "Behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So now accept a present from your servant." So he has apparently converted. He has come to the conclusion, because of the removal of his leprosy in such a dynamic fashion, that God is the only God. Yahweh, that's the divine name, is the only real God. And he wants to say thank you to the prophet Elisha by giving him things of value. And he brought a whole bunch of things of value with him. But Elisha said, "As he who is lives before whom I stand, I will receive none." He urged him to take it, but he refused. So Elisha wants to kind of start Naaman off on this idea: you don't have to pay for salvation. You don't have to pay for God's change in your life. That's a good lesson to learn as well. So he says, "No, I'm not going to accept anything from you. Just take it all with you." Naaman then gets to thinking about what the future holds for him, and he talks to Elisha the prophet about that. Naaman said, "If not, then please let there be given to your servant 2 mules load of earth. For from now on, your servant will not offer burnt offering or sacrifice to any god, but to he who is." Now, it's interesting. New believers function very often as babies. They have baby thoughts. And so this guy has grown up in a culture where gods and goddesses are very much tied to the land. Their power base is near where their temple is, where their idol is located. And the ground on which that idol is located is the holy ground. That's where you go to offer your sacrifices. So he gets to thinking, "I'm going to go back to Syria. And I want to take a piece of Israel with me because I want to worship the God of Israel. And so I can't do that on Syrian territory. So if you'll give me permission, Elisha, I'd like to dig up a couple of mule loads worth of ground from right here and make that my worship site." And apparently Elisha's response was, "Fine. If that makes you feel good, do it." Then, again, acting as a new believer, as a believer with an immature mindset, he also says this. He says, "In this matter, may he who is pardon your servant. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, he who is pardon your servant in this matter." And Elisha said back to him, "Go in peace." Now, this is what it's about. Naaman is the top military official of Syria. His boss, the only guy higher on him in the food chain, is Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. And the king of Syria worships Rimmon, the god of the Syrians, basically the same as Baal. And the king goes into the temple of Rimmon on a regular basis for state functions. And when he does that, because Ben-Hadad is an older guy now, he leans on his military commander And when the king bows down to Rimmon, Naaman knows I need to kind of bow down in my support of the king to let him lean on me. And I want you to know, Elisha, I'm not bowing to Rimmon anymore. I'm only there helping an old guy out. That's all I'm doing, is being respectful to him by letting him lean on me. And when he bows down, I have to kind of go down with him. So I'm not bowing in worship to Rimmon anymore. And Elisha's response was, again, pretty much, whatever you need to do, do it. Go in peace. I think that, you know, functioning as a religious teacher and leader myself, putting myself into the place of Elisha the prophet here, and I'm not making myself on the same level with him, I'm just saying I'm kind of fulfilling the same role. I know when dealing with new believers, sometimes they are full of all sorts of ideas, and not all of them are going to be the best things. But they're also not going to be, they're not going to be deadly dangerous to them. And so it's hard to help a new believer absorb everything at once, because they're like a newborn baby. You can't start a newborn baby on a steak dinner. You have to start them on milk and then soft food and kind of branch out from there. And so I think that's exactly what Elisha is doing, is basically thinking this guy will learn over time what needs to be done, that you don't need dirt from a special place in order to worship. And maybe you should explain to your boss that I cannot in good conscience bow in the temple of Rimmon anymore, because I don't worship him anymore. It might cost you your job, but at least your conscience will be completely clean and clear. And so I think he was leaving that for later in Naaman's life. Let's move on with the story. When Naaman had gone from him a short distance, so he's now left, he's heading back to Damascus, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, see, my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian in not accepting from his hand what he brought. As he who is lives, I'm going to run after him and get something from him. So Gehazi is one of the ministerial students. He's one of the sons of the prophets. He is perhaps even kind of the top guy within that group. And he feels like it was a mistake for Elisha not to accept the gifts of value early. And some of this is coming from the fact that Gehazi's got a bit of a greed problem. He wanted that stuff. He thought that perhaps he would benefit from such a gift. And so he is functioning from a seed of sin in his own heart. So Gehazi followed Naaman. And when Naaman saw someone running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" So Naaman gets, you know, sight of this guy running from behind and figures that maybe something happened, maybe something he could help with. And so he gets down and asks him, "Is everything okay?" And he said, "All is well. My master has sent me to you to say." So immediately now, Gehazi's seed of temptation to sin has now sprouted. He is sinning. He is now lying in order to get something. "So my master sent me to say, there has just now come to me from the hill country of Ephraim two young men of the sons of the prophets. Please give them a talent of silver," that's 75 pounds worth, "and two festal garments," so two of the 10 changes of clothing that he brought with him. So now he's using God's work, you know, because these are sons of the prophets that he's making this story up about. He's using God's work as an excuse to get this wealth for himself. So he is now exploded into full-fledged sin. This is not good. He is a religious student, perhaps even a religious leader, we should say, that has let his greed get the best of him. Verse 23, Naaman said, "Oh, please be pleased to take 2 talents. So don't just take one to split between the two guys. Take one for each of them." And he urged him, and he tied up 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 festal garments, and he laid them on 2 of his servants, and they carried them before Gehazi. Remember, this is like 75 pounds of metal. So 2 guys are carrying that amount each back toward where Gehazi came from. Now, when he came to the hill, to a certain spot, he took them from their hand, apparently 1 at a time, and he put them in the house, and then he sent the men away, and they departed. So he's got a little secret stash that he secured this 150 pounds worth of silver in, and the 2 special garments, the fruit of his sin. And then, after he secreted this stuff away, he went in and stood before his master as if nothing had happened. So he now thinks, I'm going to get away with this. Which is really foolish. I mean, he works for the top prophet of God. Elisha said to him, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" Now, immediately, he should have fessed up. This would have been his opportunity to repent and come clean. It's kind of like when Peter, in the book of Acts, asked Ananias and Sapphira both, "Are you sure you want to claim that you're giving everything from the sale of your property to God? Understand, you don't have to give any of it. You could give part of it, and that not be a big deal either. But are you saying you're giving 100% of the proceeds to God?" So when Peter did that, he was giving those 2 people a chance to fess up, to fix the sin. So here is Elisha giving Gehazi that chance. And, you know, parents do this as well as teachers when they know what the story is and they ask, "Are you sure that's what happened? You want to tell me the real story?" And the bad choice at that moment, speaking from experience back when I was a younger person and I was asked, "Is that the true story?" Yeah, you don't want to stick with your fake story. But he said, "Your servant went nowhere. I didn't go anywhere. What are you talking about?" But Elisha said to him, "Did not my heart go with when the men turned from his chariot to meet you?" He says, "Gehazi, don't you understand? I was there in spirit, thanks to God, when Naaman turned around and got out of his chariot and talked to you. I know exactly what happened. Was it a time to accept money and garments, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male servants and female servants?" Now, of course, he didn't accept any of those, but it's possible he was daydreaming about how he was going to have all those things from the money he just got. Because you can spend, buy an awful lot of olive orchards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and servants with 150 pounds of silver. So he was probably daydreaming about what his life could be like if he just had this cash. And Elisha said, "Is that really what it's all about?" And then comes the penalty phase of sin, the punishment. "Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. And so he went out of his presence a leper like snow. So by the decision of God, the punishment for Gehazi was that he would be marked as a sinner with leprosy from that moment forward. Apparently, even if he repented, which I hope he did, he would still remain marked by it. And apparently his sons and his son's sons and, you know, grandkids for quite a few generations, when they sinned, because I don't think it was a punishment for nothing. God does not punish the children for the sins of the fathers. Not in the way that we're thinking about right here. But I think that the mark of leprosy, which is not a put on all sinners, but just a select few, I think this mark of leprosy ended up being prominent within this gene pool throughout time. Perhaps some of the lepers that we meet in the Gospels might have been descendants of this genetic line. So he ends up going out with this mark on him and apparently quits being Elisha's servant. Next time we see him, he will be some sort of advisor to King Jehoram of northern Israel. 2 Kings chapter 6, we move on with some more stories of Elisha's ministry. Now, the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "See, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan and each of us get there a log and let us make a place for us to dwell there." So this is apparently pretty quick story after the last one, because we speculated that where Elisha was must have been near the River Jordan. So some of the sons of the prophets say, "Hey, look, we need another building. Our building's too small. Let's all go down to the Jordan River where there's lots of trees that grow up right next to the Jordan River. Let us all go down there and we'll all cut some lumber and bring it back and we'll build another building for our little community." And Elisha's response was, "Go." Then one of them said, "Be pleased to go with your servants." And he said, "I'll go." And so he went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. So here we have a bunch of lumberjacking going on, chopping trees right next to the river. Now, the Jordan River today is a shadow of what it was back in the days of Elisha. Now it's very narrow, and because a lot of water is drained out of it as it flows down, because there's a lot of water that needs for irrigation and drinking in that region of the world. There's a ton more people living there now than were living back at this time. But at this time, it would have been pretty wide and deep. So as one of them was felling a log, his axe head fell into the water. So it came loose from the axe handle and it goes flying out into the Jordan. And he cried out, "Oh, alas, my master, it was borrowed." So he'd borrowed this axe from somebody, which means he's now going to have to replace it. And he probably doesn't have the cash to replace something of that much value. And so he's upset. So what does Elisha do? He helps him out supernaturally. So the man of God said, "Where did it fall? Show me where it went flying off and hit the water." And so he showed him the place. And so Elisha cut off a stick and he threw it in there and it made the iron float. Now, this is not the way normal things work. You don't throw sticks into the water to make iron float. So this is supernatural. And the whole cutting of the stick and throwing it in there was just a mechanism of faith, a mechanism to enliven faith. And so amazing that the axe head floats right back up to the surface. And Elisha says, "Take it up And so he reached out his hand and he took it. And so Elisha is doing all of these supernatural things in front of his prophets, his school of the prophets, his sons of the prophets, in order to help them to become more trusting of God. And once again, this reminds me of the situation with Jesus in the New Testament Gospels. A lot of the things that Jesus did, he did in front of his disciples, in front of his apostles, to help them trust God better, so that when they went out and did their work, their ministry, they would put their faith and trust in God, and by that, set a good example for the people that they were ministering to. So I think you should always kind of keep this parallel between the ministry of Elisha and the ministry of Jesus, and the means and the mechanisms of the one kind of foreshadowing the story of Jesus. Well, we're out of time for today and for this week. Have a great weekend, great Lord's Day, and we'll get back into the Word, Lord willing, next week.